You've been searching for that time to get on some sort of a roll here to get that good feeling, and you need a game like this to give you a chance.
We're still struggling to try and score goals night in and night out, but we've been able to do that in the last couple games.
It doesn't get any easier as the season moves on. The road games get tougher and tougher.
There's not an easy answer to that.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Ezra, Dave, and Drew on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bumpin', now for Shipley, a shot, he scores! Mark Shipley with his 30th is a game winner! Jets win! Jets win! Jets win in overtime!
Michael, you're at Leafs practice. Leafs game day skate is about to start. The Leafs play the Red Wings tonight at Joe Louis Arena. I know you've been at Joe Louis Arena before. Is there, some extra, sentimentality and, emotions, in the streets of Detroit, knowing that there are only a few games left at Joe Louis Arena before they move to their new digs?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I don't know about you, but I've got a soft spot for all these old barns. I remember being at Mellon Arena in Pittsburgh, and as dumpy as some of these rinks are, because obviously they show their age, and with some of them, they almost start out as a dump, and I almost mean that in a nice way. It is kind of sad to see them go, because there is that kind of, they have a certain amount of character, where I think you go around the league right now, and as nice as these new rinks are, they all feel the same. It's a bit of a cookie-cutter feel to them. So when you go to a place like Joe Louis Arena and you see kind of like beer stains that are 20, 30 years old, there's a certain kind of mystique there. And you look around and you see, you almost feel like, okay, here's where a lot of history was made. So part of that is it's kind of, there's that sentimental fact that a bit of a sadness there where you're saying goodbye to a lot of good memories, especially for a lot of Detroiters. Had a lot of great memories cheering on the Red Wings and Gordie Howe and all the legends there. And at the same time, this is long overdue. Anyone who's been to Joe Louis Arena knows that this was an arena that was desperate for either an upgrade or just kind of a new building. So with the way that the season's gone, it's almost perfect timing. Looks like the Red Wings are finally, after, 25 years, they are going to miss the playoffs, but it looks like they're finally going to be due for a rebuild, and now they're going to a new rink where they can kind of start a new era.
Michael, the Leafs have won 2 in a row, 7 of their last 10. What's the magic number here with 6 games left?
I don't know if they're actually thinking about magic numbers, but it looks like they're going to be in the playoffs. Like, they got Detroit tonight, Buffalo on the road on Monday, and really they should be able to pick up at least 3 or 4 points there, because the rest of the schedule looks pretty tough, where they got Washington, Tampa, and then Pittsburgh, Columbus on back-to-backs. And, the way the Leafs are playing right now, this is a different team. Whereas I think in the previous months, this was a team that might have had the most victories where they scored 5 or 6 goals or more, and they were just kind of relying on their offensive dynamos. Well, in the last few weeks, that has completely changed. The Leafs are winning games like 3-1, 3-2, even 4-2, tightly fought games where they get in the empty netter. They're playing playoff hockey. They're really clamping down defensively. Their goaltending, whether it's been Anderson or McElhinney, that really bailed them out a lot of times too. So this is a team that already looks like they've kind of recognized the kind of hockey that you need to play to be successful, not just in the playoffs, but in the stretch run. So, they're impressing me because they can score at will. And we've seen it with either Nylander, Matthews, Marner, or even some of the vets like Kadri and Van Riemsdyk. But what's really been impressive is just that recognition, like, okay, games are getting tighter. We have to play on both sides of the puck. And, kudos to these guys. So a lot of young players, that's really what they kind of fight with early on in their career, is how to play that 200-foot game. So The way the Leafs are going, I think the playoffs, it's going to happen. There's not going to be a collapse, and it would take basically losing every game right now for them to miss the playoffs.
Michael, I think just to say that this year's rookie class around the NHL would be one of epic proportions. And you look here in Winnipeg, we've got obviously Patrick Laine and Josh Morrissey. Now, Josh Morrissey is a guy that kind of flies under the radar just because of the flash and pizzazz and the success of Patrick Laine. Now, focusing on the Maple Leafs, does Connor Brown going through the exact same thing as Josh Morrissey only times three?
Yeah. Well, when you look at the Leafs rookies, I don't know where Connor Brown would fit, but it's definitely behind Matthews, behind Marner, behind Nylander. And you know what? It probably is behind Nikita Zaitsev, who is their top-pairing defenseman right now. And, yeah, we're talking about a guy in Connor Brown who's just been really – like, he's one goal away from 20 goals as a rookie. Any other year for the Leafs, this guy would just be written about daily. For what he's been able to do, and he's really been one of their hotter forwards in the second half of the season. Like, if you look at his splits, he's done most of his damage, I believe, in the last few months. Post All-Star game, he's got 8 goals in 28 games, which is really impressive. So, you can really go down the list, though, with the Leafs. Like, Zach Hyman, again. To be playing on the top line really with Matthews all season long. I know he's been criticized at times for not producing offensively, but he leads the league, I believe, in power play penalty kill minutes. Plus, he's playing on the top line. So he's been really that kind of Swiss Army knife for Mike Babcock and a guy that he can trust, which is really impressive when you're talking about rookies. So, yeah, there's a lot of them to go around. And just like Josh Morrissey, I think you have to kind of watch this team on a daily basis to understand just how important a lot of these rookies are.
Michael, we're about a month removed from the NHL trade deadline, and I was just curious to see who you thought is the most impactful player that's been acquired by a team this year around.
Yeah, that's a good question. There wasn't a whole lot of important players being moved, and maybe that was a recognition of, you know, the idea of hiring a mercenary or a rental just doesn't work out a whole lot. And it's funny because Kevin Shattenkirk had the injury, and he hasn't been producing as much offensively maybe as Washington maybe thought or fans would have thought, and yet he's going to a team where there's no shortage of offensive weapons. A guy like Brian Boyle in Toronto really hasn't found his scoring touch lately since coming here. Thomas Vanek goes to Florida. While he's been productive, the Panthers are obviously going to miss the playoffs. So there wasn't a whole lot of moves where you're going, oh, yeah, that was great. If anything, I would think that the Leafs picking up Curtis McElhinney turned out to be a great addition, and yet that wasn't a trade deadline move. It was just a waiver pickup. And without him and with Anderson injured for a little bit, they really leaned on McElhinney as a backup to get some important wins. And I wonder, had the Leafs not had that backup goaltender, what would have happened during that little stretch? You could have seen maybe a different scenario where today they're on the outside looking in. But maybe this is a lesson, though, for future trade deadlines where, you know what, do your shopping early or just don't do it at all, because, you know what, at the end of the day, it doesn't really – matter a whole lot who you're picking up at the deadline.
That's what I do, Michael. I don't even go grocery shopping. I just wait for Naomi to do my shopping. We're joined by Michael Trakos of Post Media News live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Michael, three Canadian teams have now clinched a playoff berth. Calgary clinched last night. Edmonton and Montreal have already clinched. Who's been the more surprising team to you, Calgary or Edmonton?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think going into the season, I thought Calgary was going to be there, and yet with the way they started, I'm more surprised that they're there today. Edmonton, on the other hand, you were just kind of waiting year after year for when this was going to happen, and while Connor McDavid is a huge reason, I think I've been more surprised with just how impressive Cam Talbot's been. The guy's a workhorse. So is he going to play 70-plus games this year as a starter? Probably leads the league right now. And then to also be in the top 10 in goals against and save percentage is just it's wild, especially with what he dealt with last year, where it looked like he was basically a deer in the headlights going from the Rangers to the Oilers and being shelled on a nightly basis. So, you know, in some ways, I think Edmonton, I guess, turnaround has been the most impressive. Made a big couple splashes in the offseason, getting Milan Lucic, trading Taylor Hall for Adam Larson. And there were a lot of people wondering, okay, well, is this going to make them take a step forward or backwards? And you know what? With McDavid leading the way offensively and Draisaitl as well, and Talbot in net, this looks like such a better team than we've ever seen in the last 10 years. So I'll go with Edmonton right now.
Michael, you mentioned in our talk about rookies, Nikita Zaitsev, and there's talk of a seven-year contract extension for him. I'm just curious, we don't get to see the Leafs play too often. Can you maybe just describe what type of a defenseman Zaitsev is and if he's warranted a seven-year contract extension?
Yeah, he's a funny guy because he's not flashy at all. He's been playing with Morgan Riley, and Riley's been the guy that really has the free rein to kind of go up and down the ice and pinch in as a fourth forward, so to speak. And Zaitsev's been that steady kind of calming presence on that top pairing. And we didn't know really what to expect. We had seen him at the World Championships. I'd seen him at the World Cup for Russia, where he was really impressive. But you never know when a guy comes from Europe and has to change his game for the smaller ice surface and for a more physical game. But Zaitsev's been basically everything that Mike Babcock has really asked him to be. He's chipped in with goals here and there. He's killed penalties. Like I said, he's been that kind of calming presence for Riley, where you always know that Zaitsev's going to be back there. And yet I think there's more to give from this guy. I think he's got the skill set where he can chip in more points and be more productive. So it doesn't surprise me that the Leafs are looking to sign him and sign him up long-term, because he's just been really impressive as a first-year player.
Michael, you wrote a two-part series about hockey in China called Made in China, which dealt with the NHL's interest in China and the search for hockey's Yao Ming. What can the exhibition games do next season, do for to help this search?
Well, I think it's going to be a real key thing, especially if the league decides to skip the Olympics in South Korea. I think they're going to rely. It looks like they've really value Beijing and China more, way more importantly than South Korea. So, having exhibition games there's already the KHL there. And then looking ahead to, 2022 Olympics in Beijing, it looks like the NHL is doing a full-on assault in terms of really trying to generate interest and tap into that huge, huge market where there's a lot of money and just a lot of interest in hockey already. So maybe they're a couple years behind in terms of they should have been there when the KHL got there, but just having Vancouver and LA play exhibition games, already teams have been going over there, whether it's Boston, Washington, I believe a couple other teams also went. I think Vancouver's gone over a couple years already too. So I just think, like, talking to folks over there, and I have some friends already who are working as hockey coaches in China, like, rinks are being built almost weekly, and they're expecting to have them in the thousands, not the hundreds, by the time the Olympics rolls around. So with that much of a population and that much money that's being generated in China, there's no limit to what they can achieve there. And similar to the NBA, I think they're just really kind of searching for that one player that they can kind of peg the interest around, sort of like the Yao Ming. And whether that comes before the Olympics or not, don't be surprised if after Matthews was drafted out of a non-traditional market like Scottsdale, Arizona, we see someone drafted in the first round from a place like Beijing or Shanghai.
It's definitely going to be interesting to see how hockey grows in China with the Olympics coming up there in 2022. Michael, we know that you have to catch Leafs game day skate in about 15 minutes, so we really appreciate you coming on this morning.
All right, thanks, folks.
All right, enjoy the game tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Michael Trakos of Post Media News. We're going to go to a break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Jets. We're going to go over Thursday night's game And we're going to preview tonight's game between the Jets and the Senators coming up at 6 o'clock here on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an icy Saturday on TSN 1290.
You're on the curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Armia strongly towards center ice. A one-on-two. Barging toward the net. He got a hold down from behind by Getzlaff. No call. Armia picks up the puck again. Turns with a shot. No. He scores! Joel Armia with another shorthanded goal. His team leading fourth. And we're tied at one.
What a goal that was on Thursday night. Joel Armia, his fourth shorthanded goal of the year, which I believe now, if I'm not mistaken, is second in the NHL.
To Victor Arvidsson.
Victor Arvidsson having a very underrated year. I think he's up to 29 goals now.
Yeah, he has
28
five.
Goals,
29
five goals.
Shorthanded.
Good player for the Nashville Predators. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ezra Ginsberg filling in for Drew Mandel, joined by Sean Assor and Dave Manouk. Thursday night, the Jets ended up winning 4-3 in overtime after a pretty boring first couple of periods. Jets played really well, but really turned it up in that third period, outshooting the Anaheim Ducks 17-2. Mark Scheifele scoring the OT winner, his 30th of the year on his bobblehead night. We're going to preview the Jets and Senators tonight, guys. Dean Brown of TSN 1200 is going to join us next segment. I want to go back to that game on Thursday night, though, guys. You know, the Jets, six games left in the season. They've only got four games left in the season, so they have five games left in the season going into that game against the Anaheim Ducks. What does it say, guys, about this team for the second game in a row coming back from a 3-1 deficit and winning it, this time in overtime against the Devils? It was in the shootout.
Yeah, no, it was, you know what, it's funny because you anticipated it was kind of a letdown. You know, they had won a couple of games. Could they win the third one in a row? People are saying it's meaningless, and I get it. But the fact is, when you're a fan, you're paying lots of money. It's not meaningless to you. You want to be able to enjoy hockey, and you want to watch, you know, you're not paying to just sit there. You're paying to watch your team win, and and so you're cheering for that. And it really electrified the crowd. You know, Nikolaj Ehlers played a really good third period, I thought. And he really took it to the next level. His skating was very good. Got that puck to Blake Wheeler. And, you know, at that point, you kind of felt the momentum was shifting. When Blake Wheeler scored that 3-2 goal, you kind of thought, okay, well, this when it was 3-2, I thought, okay, well, this game's going to overtime. I really did. I felt like this was going to be an OT game at that point. I didn't know the Jets were going to win, obviously, but it really did feel like that was an OT game made for OT at that point. And Dustin Byfuglien kind of rumbling and bubbling and getting out. You know, they don't have to be pretty. And with 12 seconds to go, I mean, Jets fans couldn't be happier to see big number 33 score his 13th goal of the season to tie it up. And then, you know, overtime was a funny thing because, you know, they both teams had, you know, chances. Jets had the better chances. And then I really thought it was kind of humorous to watch that setup because, you know, Scheifele gets the puck back to Byfuglien, who goes back to Scheifele, and Blake Wheeler is in front. And the most entertaining part about it was he had his arm up before Scheifele scored the goal. So you got Blake Wheeler with his arm raised. He was that confident that Scheifele's getting that goal that he literally was already celebrating. And I actually found it to be quite humorous. I was like, I've never seen that before, where a guy's actually celebrating before the goal's actually gone in the net. So, no, you know what? Like I said, the fact is, to be honest with you, I actually thought it was necessary from the perspective of the fan base needed something to cheer for. And again, I get that these games are meaningless, but the truth is, you know, when you're shelling out big money for some people, it's you want to be able to know that you're enjoying what you're watching. And I think that fans, especially in the third period, first period, I mean, again, you're right, as that Joel Armia goal was, I mean, right after he just got knocked down by Ryan Getzlaff, gets back up, you know, fights for the puck. Byfuglien, I believe, was also in on that forecheck, I believe. And then Armia just takes a shot. And, you know, Bernier probably should have had it. But still, like, the fact is that Armia has been very good. When he had the opportunity, when Patrick Laine got high-sticked, he went in on Patrick Laine in the power play, rang one off the crossbar. So I actually thought Joel Armia had a really nice game in the first two periods. I thought he was the best Jet.
And there's no doubt that goal that Buff scores to tie it up was an ugly goal. But when you go to the net and Byfuglien crashes the net, good things often happen, right? So it doesn't really matter. The fact is that they tied it up, forced it into overtime, and Scheifele got the game-winning goal. Sean, with four games left in the season, you know, the Jets have won three games in a row. Do you read it into anything with these three victories here? I realize that the Jets, you know, aren't going to the playoffs. We all realize the Jets aren't going to the playoffs. There just isn't enough time to make up those points. But what do you make of these last three victories and the way the Jets have come back from deficits two games in a row?
Well, it's easy to go out there and say that, you know, they're meaningless games and it's easy to play loose and free when there's nothing to play for. But the fact of the matter is, when you come down 3-1 in back-to-back games, this team is playing for something. They're playing for pride. They're playing for each other. They're playing for development. They're playing to kind of light the fire for next season. You know, you can end the season on a strong note, look at each other, look at your fellow player in the eye and say, okay, next year we come back and it's down to business. We carry this through into next season, throughout the season, and then hopefully into the postseason. For me, the Scheifele overtime winner says a lot. It's very indicative of kind of the development of this whole team. You look at 2 years ago when the Jets and the Ducks met in the playoffs. Does Mark Scheifele fight off Ryan Kesler all the way down the ice, maintain control of the puck in front of the net, make that play back to Buff? I think he gets knocked down. You know, there was that knock on him that he has trouble standing on his feet when he's battling with bigger, stronger centermen. Mark Scheifele maintained possession the entire time, fighting off one of the best two-way centermen in the game for the game winner, who then blew his coverage for that game winner. So I just think that that play is so significant when it comes to kind of the development of Mark Scheifele individually and just kind of as a whole, just where this team is going. And I think it's pretty encouraging.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, we haven't even talked about Michael Hutchinson after giving up those three goals. Mm-hmm. He was very solid. I mean, again, he didn't have to be spectacular. I mean, two shots in the third period. In my opinion, the Anaheim Ducks were totally just sitting back. And
17-2 in shots.
Absolutely.
Like that's insane.
And it's impressive, though, that he's getting wins at this point in the season. A couple of weeks ago, guys, we were talking about Connor Hellebuyck and the potential for him to start all of the remaining games, right? So pretty impressive that Michael Hutchinson picks up the win after, you know, he had a bit of a shaky start to the game. And I think that's a good point that you make, Sean, when you talk about the Anaheim Ducks. Coming into this game, they were leading the division. They had won 8 of their last 10 games. So, I mean, this is a moral victory because at this point in the season, what else are you really playing for, right? You're not playing for a playoff spot. So you're playing for next year in the sense that you want to beat good teams in the West. And I realize that their other two games were against Vancouver and New Jersey, both non-playoff teams. But when you're talking about the Ducks, they could easily win the division. Edmonton's pushing right now, and San Jose and Calgary are still in it. But I think when you talk about Mark Scheifele, I mean, this is a team that I think not only do they want to get back into the playoffs next year, but they want to prove that if they get back there, they can win a round or maybe more.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Ez, and that's the whole point. And you know, sometimes I'm not so sure I believe in the whole, like, we've won three, we can keep that rolling. Because, again, in theory, that's what happened last year, right? They won their final four, and then obviously they weren't able to kind of keep that momentum going because, you know, you've got a big gap of time. But the reality also is that you have big injuries, right? You know, you lose Brian Little in game one. Well, that changes your whole focus of the season, and that's the reason why it's very hard to keep that kind of rolling. But, you know, look, again, I'm not really so concerned about what the team's doing. I mean, sure, it's important for these games, but from a fan base perspective, I think, you know, folks want to see the team doing well, and they want to know that they're going to a game and the game has meaning, and the players are going to give a 60-minute effort, or in this case, you know, a 60-minute and, you know, 63-minute and 34-second effort. So I think from a fan's perspective, I think that those people who are sitting in the building, knowing that they're going to games, knowing that the games and the players are trying till the end, is not a bad thing.
Also, can we just kind of look at each other in the eye and give props to Nelson Noje for going up against Jared Bull after Mark Stewart got pasted into the boards?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what's funny is Jared Bull, I believe, is leading the league in fighting majors. He's a guy that has, I think, 100-plus career fights. Rick tweeted it out on Thursday night. And Nelson Noje, not only is he not a guy that fights a lot, he's only 20 years old going up against a known heavyweight, right? So that fight didn't last very long, Sean. But I agree with you. Good for him for dropping the gloves with a guy who certainly is a known fighter and a step above him in the weight class.
Nelson Oje, 5 NHL PIMS. Jared Bull, 1,282 PIMS.
And you know, it's interesting because when Nojé fought Bol, first of all, I was like, he definitely didn't see the name on the back of the jersey before he decided to drop the gloves, because that he wouldn't have done that if he knew who.
He's like, Bol, it's Bol. Okay. Oh, oops. Okay. I guess I better follow through with this.
I thought I misread that. And then the other thing also is that it was reminiscent of a game actually that knocked him out for the Moose when he actually got into a fight about a month ago, I think, and at the Moose Blue Line, and he kind of got ragdolled and thrown into the ice. And so Nelson Nojé, young guy, isn't a big fighter for Manitoba or for the Jets. And, you know, he stood in for a teammate, which wasn't a bad thing to see. But I had visions of that, because that's kind of the way he went down to the ice and he'd cut himself. So good for him for standing up.
Guys, we're going to head to break here because we've got Dean Brown, Ottawa Senators play-by-play broadcaster for TSN 1200 coming up. Some breaking news. Munsey just tweeting out that Tyler Myers is on the ice in a regular defenseman jersey for the Jets.
Ooh.
So maybe we will see Tyler Myers before the end of the season. But even if we don't, it's good to see him back in a regular jersey for the Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, we'll be joined by Dean.
Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Ezra Ginsberg with Sean Asor and Dave Minuk. We're working on getting Dean Brown of TSN 1200 on the line. Now, this Ottawa Senators team, guys, right now 91 points, second in the Atlantic Division. They're in danger of possibly being passed by the Toronto Maple Leafs. Only 2 points behind, a huge game tonight between the Jets and the Senators, 6 o'clock. Hustler and Lawless is going to kick off game day coverage live from Boston Pizza City Place at 3 o'clock, and then Rick Ralph is going to be by with the Manitoba Building Trades pregame show, 5 o'clock, also live from Boston Pizza City Place. A very interesting team, the Senators. They've only won 3 of their last 10 games, and they had a closed-door meeting after their last loss to the Minnesota Wild, 5-1. And it's a team, when you look at it, I mean, they've been in a playoff spot comfortably for the majority of the season, and they've started to falter a little bit here, guys. And they are kind of locked in, but you wonder if the Ottawa Senators are beginning to get a little bit afraid that they actually might fall into a wild card spot.
Yeah, no, it's, and you know, the truth is they have some injuries. Burrows is hurt right now. Carlson's hurt. So they've got some guys that are, I think Neal's also might be hurt. So
the thought.
Yeah, so they've got some injuries, and they're just resting up their team for the most part. But yeah, you're right. When you go 3-4-3 in your last 10 after being as hot as they were, it's a little bit surprising. And, you know, they went into that Minnesota game anticipating that, you know, they'd be able to come out with a victory. I don't think they had lost in Minnesota. I mean, obviously they don't play there very often, but I don't think they had lost in Minnesota since a regulation loss since like 2004. And then they went in there and, you know, they obviously got tuned 5-1. So never a good thing. Ottawa's going to be coming in. It should make for a good game because, you know, Ottawa kind of has to have a good night tonight. They want to, like you said, they don't want to fall out of that spot. It'll be interesting to see what the team brings tonight to the MTS Center.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have Rory's working on getting Dean Brown of TSN 1200 on the line. So we're going to hit the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline right now.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We're pleased to be joined by Ottawa Senators play-by-play broadcaster for TSN 1200, Dean Brown, live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Dean, good morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Morning, boys. No problem.
Dean, I wanted to get a question in right at the beginning of the segment here on Erik Karlsson. He missed the game on the last game versus the Minnesota Wild, a 5-1 loss. It was the first game that he's missed after playing 324 consecutive games. Does Erik get enough credit for his durability?
I guess probably not. It's one of those things where it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. You never really think about it because he's just there all the time. But, yeah, he's been very durable. And to be honest with you, the injury that he had before that, if you remember back, you know, the whole Iron Man streak started after he got his Achilles tendon severed by Cook, you know, Matt Cook. So it wasn't really a normal kind of hockey injury that kind of kept him out the last time.
Dean, I was watching the Pens-Rangers game yesterday, and I kind of was watching Mika Zibanejad and him doing his thing on the ice, and it kind of got me thinking, knowing that you were going to join the show today, how's Derek Brassard doing in his first full year with the Senators?
He's been okay, and just okay. And, you know, it's one of those things where they got him because he's got more playoff experience. And basically, he was the older version of Mika, to be honest with you, in their eyes, where you had a guy where you could see all the potential, but it just wasn't there as far as the production went, and you didn't know if it ever was going to be. And Broussard has kind of been the same for Ottawa, just an older version of that. He has not been, you know, nearly as good, I think, as they had hoped. And I think what they're hoping is that playoff experience when the playoffs starts, you know, that's when that makes the deal worthwhile for them. But he certainly hasn't been lighting things up. He certainly hasn't been turning people's heads where they say, that was definitely a great trade for Ottawa. I think it's still going to be one of those trades that's debated for a while. Because, to be honest with you, aside from his injury in New York, Mika has been very up and down as well. So the irony is that the guys in New York are talking about Mika about the same way as the guys in Ottawa are talking about Broussard. Neither one has really lit it up, you know.
Dean, are the Senators the team set up to make a deep playoff run? And what would be the biggest area of concern for Ottawa?
I think probably, you know, when they're healthy, if they're healthy, you know, that's obviously the biggest thing for this team is that, you know, like most teams in this league now in a salary cap era, depth is the issue. You know, right now without having their top two defensemen in Carlson and Mathot, that's a hole that they have a very, very hard time filling. And I suppose that's the same for almost any team. Like here in Winnipeg, it's hard to get any sympathy for Ottawa in that, you know, you look at how much of this year the Jets have done without, you know, Toby Enstrom and Tyler Myers, and, you know, it's pretty hard to get sympathy from people around this league. But the reality is Ottawa's not nearly the same team when you take out, you know, the best defenseman in the world and his partner, and they're out at the same time. So depth is probably an issue for as far as playoffs go. And I think probably the other thing is offense. You know, this team has become this year twice as good as they were last year defensively, but the offense is only half as good as it was. So I think that's probably one of the issues if they get going in the playoffs on some nights will be, can they score enough?
We're joined by Dean Brown, Ottawa Senators play-by-play announcer for TSN 1200, live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Dean, what do you think the chances are that we see Colin White play for the Senators this year?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know, 50-50. He'd have to agree to his entry-level contract first, and the way the league rules work is that he would have to have his entry-level contract agreed to, signed, and filed with the league 24 hours before their last regular season game for him to qualify to play in the playoffs. And I think, to be honest with you, that's going to be pretty much up to him. You know, they continue to negotiate with him. He's on the ATO, the amateur tryout, with the minor league team in Binghamton right now. But for him to sign a entry-level contract, it's really more in his lap. You know, they've been negotiating back and forth, but as we all know, with entry-level contracts, there's only so many things that you can give a player. There's only so many bonuses you're allowed to give them under the rules. So entry-level contracts are usually not that complicated. So it's really more a function of when he chooses to sign his, more so than when the Senators give him what he wants. You know, I guess the answer is that no one really knows the answer right now, including the Senators. He's the guy who's got to agree to an entry-level contract for this to even have a possibility of happening.
Dean, I'm going to ask you the exact same question, but I'm going to do a bit of a name swap. What are the chances that we see Clark MacArthur suit up for the Senators this year?
Oh, zero. He wants to come back and he wants to get tested again. But even if he takes the test and passes them all, three doctors have to agree that it's a good medical idea for him to play. And I'm not a doctor. I don't know the doctors doing the testing, but I find it very difficult to imagine that no matter what the test results are, that three doctors are going to say that a guy who's had four concussions in 18 months should play again. So I know that he wants to play. I know that he hopes to play. I know that he's taking baseline tests and wants to try and play before the end of the season. I understand that. I just sincerely doubt it's going to happen.
Dean, in his last 10 games, Bobby Ryan has no points. What would you say is wrong with his game?
Probably just getting shots, number one. Number two, maybe some bad luck. You know, he's in front of the net all the time on the power play and knocks the puck down but can't bury it, you know. So there's some bad luck and just volume of shots. Sometimes he's one of those guys that's always looking for the pretty pass instead of just taking the shot himself. I think probably the biggest thing for him is that he should once again start trusting his shot. He was a 35-goal scorer in this league for a reason, and it wasn't because they were deflecting in off him, so... You know, the coaching staff is always trying to get him to shoot more than he does.
We're joined by Dean Brown on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Dean, are we expecting Craig Anderson to get the start net for the Senators tonight?
Uh, that's a good question. Don't know. I would not be surprised if this is a game that Mike Condon plays. You know, they have back-to-back games, excuse me, on Monday and Tuesday against Detroit. And so I think there's probably one of two thoughts, and one of two thoughts would be if Condon plays tonight, they have a better chance of playing Anderson back-to-back against Detroit, or maybe they don't want to play Anderson back-to-back. They've gone with both. We can't really say that there's the one thing they always do, so this is what they'll likely do again. But Anderson in Minnesota wasn't particularly sharp, so there might be a case to be made that he might need a little bit of a mental rest. So my long answer is I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if Condon gets the game tonight.
Dean, the Senators coming off a 5-1 loss in Ottawa, not a great score moving forward at this time of the year, but kind of, is everyone a winner at a game like that with the story of, I hope I don't butcher the last name, Jonathan Petry, and with regards to what happened with the game with that?
Yeah. For those who don't know Jonathan Petry's story, he's a young man from Ottawa who's actually in Minnesota right now, having an attempt at a second stem cell research, stem cell transplant. Because he's got a rare condition, basically, where his skin is like thin as paper. And so it's a life debilitating thing. And anyway, the entire team, when they got to Minnesota, basically got on the buses and went over to see him, surprised him. He's in a condo in Minnesota waiting to begin treatments actually yesterday. And so they surprised him. And it's just a very uplifting story. And it really was a very emotional thing, both for the players and for the kid. But it would have been better for everybody involved if they would have come out on the ice and not laid an egg against Minnesota. But it doesn't negate the fact that it was a very special visit, and he didn't know. First of all, it was a surprise. He didn't know they were coming until the whole team poured through the door, and just, you know, everybody on the team knows what he's got coming up ahead of him and how technical things can be, and so it was a pretty special day.
Dean, we've just got one last question for you here. Right now, it looks like the Ottawa Senators and the Toronto Maple Leafs are locked in to play each other in the first round. That is, of course, unless one of those teams drops down to one of those wild card spots. How do you think the Senators match up against the Leafs in a first round series?
You know what? Almost any of the teams that Ottawa would play in the first round, you can't really say that one team dominates the other. I think they match up about the same as they would against Boston or... You know, had the Islanders kept making their charge and have been a more serious contender, they would have been about the same. All those teams kind of in that area, the 6-7-8 in the Eastern Conference. I'm not sure if there's any big difference between the two of them. The big difference is in the one wild card spot that comes from the other division. You know, Montreal, ironically enough, you know, they're going to win the division, and they're going to have the hardest matchup in the first round. You know, I don't think there's any question that the New York Rangers are going to be a harder out than any of the other teams that are going to be in the bottom part of the Eastern Conference in the playoffs. So for Ottawa, I'm not sure that you could say that one team, if they end up playing Toronto, I'm not sure you can say that one team or the other is the favorite. Just as I don't think you could, if it was Boston, for example, I don't think you could say that, you know, one team is the favorite over the other. So it would be interesting to see, but they're both pretty even, and I'm not sure there is a favorite between the two of them.
Dean, I hope it's just not a repeat of it was either 2001 or 2002 when I went with my family to Ottawa and we were scheduled to go see Game 5 of the Senators-Leafs series, and the Senators were swept that year by the Leafs.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't want to see that either because I get paid by the game. So.
Dean.
Whatever happens, I just want it to take a lot of games to get there.
Yeah, we want the Senators to go all the way. Stanley Cup Finals, right?
4-7-game series.
Dean, thanks so much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and have a good call tonight.
Thanks very much, guys.
All right, let's head to break, guys. When we come back, we're going to talk about... Who do you think we're going to talk about?
Tucker Poolman.
Yep, we're going to talk about Tucker Poolman. He signed a contract earlier this week, his entry-level contract, so we're going to go over that, and we're going to play a little bit of his press conference before the Jets-Ducks game on Thursday. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Big thanks to Dean Brown of TSN 1200 for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Jets and Senators tonight, puck drop 6 o'clock p.m. Central. Hustler and Lawless are going to kick off game day coverage at 3 o'clock from Boston Pizza City Place, and then they're going to be followed up by Rick Ralph and Friends at 5 o'clock. Big news this week in Winnipeg Jets land was Tucker Poolman signing his entry-level deal after playing 3 years at the University of North Dakota. Dave, both you and I have seen Tucker Poolman play at UND at Ralph Engelstad Arena. I guess, guys, were you surprised that Tucker Poolman signed after we thought maybe he was going to wait a little bit into the spring and summer? And I guess the more important question is, when Tucker Poolman does return from his shoulder surgery, are we expecting him to play the majority of the season with the Manitoba Moose next year?
It's a really good question, and it's actually shoulder surgeries because he needs more than one, right? He had the first one on Friday, and I believe he said in his scrum that he expects the next one, depending on how that first one went, to happen sometime, I think, within a month. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks with Tucker Poolman because, you know, we've seen guys who have shoulder surgeries, and you know, it can take anywhere from 4 to 6 months. So, I mean, having it, you know, around April, you know, probably puts him into October, which means, you know, in theory, if it goes late, it could take him out of training camp, which if that's the case, then obviously you see Tucker Poolman playing with the Manitoba Moose to start the season next year, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, obviously folks want to see Tucker Poolman in the NHL. They think he's ready. Brad Schlossman, who covers him for the Grand Forks Herald, has done a lot of reporting on Tucker Poolman and says he's NHL ready. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him.
Guys, I want to play a little bit of Tucker Poolman's pregame audio scrum, just about 30 seconds, him talking about recovering from injury and his decision to sign with the Jets and his plan moving forward.
Why was it important for you to sign with this organization? Were some people maybe speculating that you maybe gone to UFA instead?
You know, it's just, you know, I wanted to be a part of the Jets, you know, with you know, the people they have in place here and the organization and the city. It's something I want to be a part of, and you know, I'm excited to be part of the future.
Do you know what your recovery time is on the surgery?
They say it's 4 to 6 months, so it's really, you know, depends how things go. You can't really forecast too much in the future, but I should be able to be pretty healthy by the time next season rolls around.
You know, Tucker Poolman, I thought it was very interesting before that Jets-Ducks game on Thursday night, guys. He spoke with the media for, I think it was about 6 or 7 minutes. And, you know, this is a defenseman. When you consider that the Jets don't have very many top D prospects in the system, there was a lot of hype around Tucker Poolman. He was almost a point-per-game player for UND this year, won a national championship with University of North Dakota, playing with guys like Brock Besser and Tyson Jost this year. UND didn't make it to the Frozen Four this year, but I think it's very interesting to see a prospect like this. You don't necessarily have too many guys that are under contract that weren't under contract, and then they sign a one-year deal, and there was quite a bit of hype around a Poolman, and I think, you know, guys, is it mainly because we don't have that many prospects in the Jets system? That's why there's so much hype around him?
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where, I mean, he was a 2013 fifth rounder, but the fact is that he's developed into a nice piece for the UND Fighting Hawks, which still feels weird to say, but And the fact is that you can't. He's a big boy and he's a local kid, so there's an expectation that, you know, he was going to sign. And there was a lot of controversy or consternation, I should say, from fans saying that he wasn't going to sign here, that he was going to take weight and because why would he play another year? And the fact is he wants to play with his brother. I mean, the guy's he's a Minnesota kid, even though he's from East Grand Forks. Always that sounds also a little bit unusual, but the fact is he wanted to play a year with his brother, got that opportunity, came. You know, I mean, for him, Winnipeg Jets are the local team. It's either the Jets or the Wild, right? So, and we are closer than Minnesota. So than the Minnesota Wild are to him, and you could hear it in his pregame press conference that he was talking about what it would mean to play for this organization, and also he's probably looking at the depth in the Jets' defensive pool and saying, here's an opportunity. If you look at Minnesota, right, like a team like Minnesota, for example, I'm saying they've got a lot of defensive depth. You know, the Jets don't have that same depth, especially with the types of prospects who could make that jump. You know, in maybe next year with the Moose, we'll see a few new guys, possibly a Sammy Niku, that sort of idea, mm-hmm. where these guys are going to be young up-and-comings, but not guys who are necessarily ready to make that NHL jump. Whereas Tucker Poolman, and again, as you and I have both seen him play in college, it is a big jump from college to the NHL, but he has 3 seasons under his belt. you know, in theory, he could make that jump and potentially start to contribute.
Yeah, I think when you look at where he'll be placed next year with regards to the league, you know, AHL, NHL, I think his age has a lot to do with it. He's 24 years old, so he doesn't have to go through that development era or phase where he's going up as a 19, 20-year-old against guys that are 3-4 years into their development ahead of him. He's kind of maturing into his man body, and, you know, he's developing the strength and the tools he needs to compete at the high level. Plays the off wing. He's comfortable doing so. Chevy apparently went and had a talk. They met in person. Chevalier went and spoke to the guy, in person, kind of laid out where he thinks he belongs on the roster, where he thinks he could fit in. So I think what we've learned this year is that with regards to defensemen, Chevy's a great in-person negotiator.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with Tucker Pullman's development, guys, because he's got the size, and at University of North Dakota, we're going to talk to Brad Berry at 11 o'clock. We're going to talk to him about Tucker Pullman. He's played in all different types of situations. He was out there on the first power play unit. He played penalty kill and even strength. So I think there's a lot of hype surrounding him, but I think it's warranted because he's shown that he has a lot of versatility. He's got the size, and he's a guy that might slot in nicely as maybe a fifth or sixth defenseman. It remains to be seen if he's going to be a top four defenseman. There aren't as many top four defensemen in the NHL as you would think. Everybody kind of thinks, you know, there is that many top four defensemen, but maybe he will, maybe he won't. But at 23 years old, I think that, you know, there's a lot of upside with this young defenseman.
The other thing about it is that he played big minutes for UND. Mm-hmm. He played Brad Schlossman, again, of the Grand Forks Herald, said that he was playing between 25 and 30 minutes a game. So, I mean, there's a guy who has, again, Sean, you're talking about a guy who is kind of matured and he's ready to handle kind of the added responsibility of the NHL hockey. You know, again, the pace is different, but can he handle the minutes? Can he handle the size of the opponents? Probably can. So he's a big boy himself. You know, he didn't look like – sometimes you talk to prospects and you're like, wow, these guys are kids. Pullman looks like he's like a young man. Like he's not – doesn't look like a kid. So that should serve him well next season, either with the Moose or with the Jets.
Over under, how many games does he play for the Jets next year, guys?
I'll say, do I set the over-under?
Well, I guess, yeah. How many games do you think he's going to play? I didn't set the over-under. Yeah. Over-under, 20 games.
Over 20 games. I think over 20.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I would be inclined to go over 2 because of injury. And you never know what's going to happen with injury. You never know what's going to happen with, again, we don't know what's going to happen with the expansion draft. And we don't know what's going to happen with potential trades of players who they may want to sign long-term. And if they don't get those long-term deals, then they may have to trade them and then you have to make a call to the Moose.
It's also a one-year deal, so they kind of want to see what they have with him maybe in that full year, assess, and then move forward.
Yeah, and especially with injuries, I don't think anybody expected Nelson Noje to play any games with the Jets this year, and Julian Melchiori has gone into quite a few games this year. And
I don't think Nelson Noje expected Nelson Noje to play this year.
Especially with Brian Strait. I mean, he's pretty much taken Brian Strait's call-up spot on the Jets.
And, you know, there's still the uncertain future of Toby Enstrom. There's the uncertain future of Jacob Trouba, right? And we expect Jacob Trouba and Toby Enstrom to be members of the Winnipeg Jets next year. But with the expansion draft coming up, guys, there is the possibility that the Jets only protect three defensemen. And one of those defensemen that would be left exposed would be one of Tyler Myers or Jacob Trouba, because we know that Toby Enstrom and Dustin Byfuglien both have no move clauses. So Toby Enstrom would have to waive his no move clause in order to be traded by the Winnipeg Jets. But I think I'm going to say over as well. I think a lot of people expect Tucker Pullman, myself included, a couple of weeks ago, that he would spend the majority of the season with the Manitoba Moose. But when you look at his upside and the fact that, as we said, he's not coming into the NHL as an 18 or 19 year old. He's played 3 years of college hockey. He's 23 years old and he's got the size. We know that he can handle the bigger bodies that you're going to see in the NHL. So I think he is going to play more than 20 games. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Josh Green on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline. You're listening to IC on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Legal Curve Hockey Show. It's the second hour. Ezra Ginsberg joined with Dave Manuk and Sean Assor. We're working on getting Josh Green on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. So in the meantime, guys, I want to go back a month to some of the moves that were made at the NHL trade deadline. You had some significant moves and you had some minor moves. And I want to go over with you guys which moves that you thought were the most impactful. I guess let's start off with Kevin Shattenkirk being traded to the Washington Capitals. And is it safe to say that that move has had the most impact when you consider how good the Capitals have been lately, especially the power play?
Yeah, no, I think it's been phenomenal. I mean, the fact is when you get a defenseman like Kevin Shattenkirk, you know, you're never going to be complaining. The one thing, and Michael Tracheau spoke about it when we had him on to start the show, that I'm always worried about when you make these big, especially a bigger move like a Kevin Shattenkirk type, is that it ruins your chemistry. Right. And then it takes a little bit. You don't have a lot of time to kind of get it back, which is why I like it when teams. I mean, obviously, you don't like it from the perspective of, you know, from a radio perspective or TV perspective. But that's why I kind of like it when teams make those moves a couple of weeks before. And you really give your team an opportunity to have like two solid months of kind of rebuilding a chemistry when you're putting a player like Kevin Shattenkirk, who will play a major role on your team. But I mean, I do like the move for Washington. And the truth is, Washington had built up so much momentum that realistically, they could afford to have a few stumbles here and there along the way before they made it to the Stanley Cup playoffs.
The next move I want to look at is Marty Hanzel. Minnesota Wild acquired him. The Wild have been struggling big time lately. He's actually been pretty good. But Martin Hanzel, what did you guys think of that move?
Yeah, I thought it was a good move. You look at a team that's poised to make a little bit of a run, Minnesota, in their own mind, they feel it's their time. And you load up with a 6'6" centerman, a responsible two-way centerman. I think it's a great pickup. You add some depth also in forward Ryan White. Add a little bit of sandpaper. You want to talk about playoff identity. There's a player that you'd love to have go to war with you in the postseason. But Marty Hanzel, I mean, he's missed the last three games, apparently due to strep throat. He's been struggling at times, but for a team that's poised to, you know, make a playoff run if everything kind of, if they can turn things around and get back on the winning ways, I think it's a really good pickup for a team that is looking pretty solid down the middle.
Is it safe to say that the LA Kings acquiring Ben Bishop and Jerome Iginla has been the most disappointing move, or is it not as disappointing because the LA Kings were already out of a playoff spot?
I don't think Ben Bishop and Jerome Iginla are going to turn your season around and lead your team to the playoffs. I mean, yeah, Ben Bishop is a quality goaltender, but what did LA need? They needed some speed, and they needed some scoring. Yeah, they got a little bit of scoring with Jerome Iginla. The speed? Well, I don't think so.
And I think, should we be surprised, guys, really, that a lot of these moves haven't had the intended impact when you consider that they were minor moves and more so depth moves? So you had moves like the Philadelphia Flyers acquiring Valtteri Filppula, and you had the Pittsburgh Penguins acquiring guys like Ron Hainsey and Mark Strait. I think one of the moves that has had the biggest impact is Patrick Eves on the Anaheim Ducks. He was acquired, and now he's playing top-line minutes on the Anaheim Ducks. Is it safe to say that that was one of the best moves that was made at the trade deadline?
Yeah, I think Eves has looked very good for Anaheim. And, you know, he's a veteran presence. He mm-hmm. goes right in fairly seamlessly, and he knows what to do. So, I mean, when you get a guy like that who can, like I said, there's really the transition is a lot easier because he's able to slip into that role. He's been moved before, so it's not a huge change for him.
Dave, we've got Josh Green on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline. Let's hit it.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Josh Green, thank you very much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
No problem. My pleasure. How are you guys?
We're doing well, Josh. You know, talking a little Jets hockey, and then we're getting into some trade deadline moves there, waiting for you to come on. You recently retired from the Finnish Elite League with Kuku Kovola. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, Josh. Can you let
close.
Us know?
Close.
Yeah. Hopefully I was somewhat close. Can you tell us what that was like for yourself to retire after so many years playing pro hockey?
Well, I should correct you. I haven't really officially retired yet. I'm probably pretty close, but I'm going to take some time here with the family and then make a decision here soon, but haven't officially yet. But the last 4 years I've been in Finland, and it's been an unbelievable experience. I wasn't sure what to expect when I first went there, but my first 2 years were with a different team. We went to the finals both years. We had disappointing endings. We lost actually in the finals in Game 7 in overtime both years. So that was tough, but the experience was unbelievable. The people over there were great, much like people are here in Canada. They're very friendly and very accommodating, and I've got nothing but good things to say about my time in Finland.
Josh, you played six games with a kid that folks around here know named Patrick Laine, and then you played against him the following year. What did you notice with him, both as a teammate and as an opponent?
First couple of years, he was around, but he wasn't playing a whole lot. He was kind of learning how to, you know, become a professional, and you could always tell that, you know, he obviously had the size and he had the skill. He just hadn't yet figured it out yet, but playing against him last year in the league, he kind of just took off. He was a good player early in the year, and he was unbelievable down the stretch. And obviously in the playoffs, he won a championship there. He was the best player in the playoffs. And then, you know, obviously from there, he went to the World Championships and was the best forward there. So it's amazing to me how far he's come from when I first met him when he was 16.
Josh, I'm curious. There's been a lot of discussion around the NHL and hockey just specifically lately about what they're calling the little taps, the slashes on the hand to kind of deter the puck carrier from making moves or, you know, completing a play. As a player yourself, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the action? And do you think we'll ever see this removed from hockey?
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, it's always been part of the game. And it's a way for defenders to knock the puck off the stick of the guy that's got it. And I think if you start, you know, tinkering with that and taking that out of the game, it just kind of wrecks the integrity of the game. It's been around so long, and it's kind of, you know, almost tricks the trade of a defending player on things to do with the stick. And obviously you don't want to see injuries like we've seen recently here, but, you know, maybe that's the equipment. I know guys are wearing such light gloves, and they want to feel the puck so that, you know, that maybe there's not as much protection there as they should be. But I just don't see them getting that out of the game. I don't know how you would enforce that. And to answer your question, I don't see them getting rid of it. I think it's part of it. And like I said, unfortunate that guys are getting hurt, but you know, that's hockey.
We're joined by Josh Green on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline. Josh, you, of course, played a couple seasons with the Manitoba Moose when you were a member of the Vancouver Canucks organization. When you heard that the Manitoba Moose were coming back last year, did that bring back memories when you were a member of the Moose?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I'm glad they're back here. It's obviously great for the Jets to have them so close. And I first came to Winnipeg in 04 during the lockout year. And this has pretty much been my home ever since. I was in Alberta for a couple of years, but I met my wife here in 04, and we've raised a family here. Obviously, we've been in Europe quite a bit, so we're only here, you know, 5-6 months of the year. But this is home for me now, and it's great to see the Moose back in town and with the Jets. It's a hockey-rich city, and it's great for the city.
You know, Josh, they had the retro game for the Moose about a little while back. And, you know, I was looking at your career, and you played in 04, 05, and like you said. And I think that was the last year of the Winnipeg Arena. And then I think 05, 06 was the first year of the MTS Center. So what were your kind of maybe fondest memories of each of those barns?
I played at the old arena so briefly that I don't have a lot of memories. I remember actually playing an exhibition game when I was with the Edmonton Oilers against Vancouver there. That probably was in maybe 01 or 02. Maybe I played like 7 or 8 games at the old rink, and then you know, it felt like it was right away that we were moving into the new rink, and that's kind of where all my memories begin for my time here with the Moose. You know, the opening game there was unbelievable. I actually didn't play that game because we had too many overage players, and they had promised Jimmy Roy that he was going to play in those games. So that was fine with me. He deserved to be in those games. He's got such a tradition here in Winnipeg. So, but my memories of playing with the Moose that year was just the good team that we had, and the deep run. Of course, it was the lockout year, so you know, we were kind of the only show in town as far as hockey, and we had unbelievable fan support. I remember a couple of games actually being totally sold out at the MTS Center, so that was an amazing memory. And you know, obviously I liked it so much that I've stayed here and made my home here, but playing for the Moose, I have great memories.
Josh, it's going to be a really interesting offseason with regards to the Vegas expansion draft and the assembly of their team. I'm curious, from a player's perspective, is it a good idea for the NHL to release the list of names from each team of the players that are going to be put on the expansion rosters?
I think it can go both ways. I think for the guys that are left off it, it's going to be tough for them, especially if they don't get picked up and they come back to their team that you know left them off. But I think it's great. Like, we're trying to sell the game to the fans, and that's what the fans they want to see. They want to see who's protected, who's not, how it's all going to shake down. So, and players have thick skin. They can get through it. And you know, if they end up with a team that didn't protect them, they can go back and it'll be fine. It's just part of the game, part of the business. And the main thing is just trying to sell the game to the fans and doing what the fans want to see.
Josh, you know, I was looking back, at your last year in the WHL, you played for the Portland Winterhawks, and on that team it featured a young Marian Hossa. What was it like to play with Marian Hossa back then, and how surprised are you that he's still contributing like he is for the Chicago Blackhawks?
Well, I'm not surprised at all. He was so good in junior. I think he might have been 18 at the time, just drafted, and he would go into games and just dominate. His skill level was so far ahead of everybody else, and he was so fast, and it was a pleasure to play with him, and it doesn't surprise me at all to see what he's accomplished in the NHL and how many games he's played and how many points he's gotten. He's had an unbelievable career, possibly a Hall of Fame career, and he was such a good guy, too. He didn't speak much English at the time, but he loved to be around the guys and joke around, and he was just kind of learning the North American culture, but well, what an unbelievable talent he was.
Josh, you've had a career that, you know, you said it's not yet over, but it's spanned almost two decades. What do you attribute your longevity to in hockey?
Just the love for the game, I think. I probably could have shut her down, you know, 5-6 years ago if I wanted to, but I just love competing and love being around the guys and, you know, in that dressing room setting. And I'm fortunate that I have a family that allows me to do what I love to do. You know, they have no problem following me around overseas or wherever it is. And I think I've stayed relatively injury free. I had some major injuries early in my career, but I was able to get past those and, a few bumps and bruises here lately, but for the most part, I've been fairly injury free. And I think that's a big part of it too.
Josh Patrick Eliash announcing his retirement yesterday. I'm just curious, you played a long time in the NHL. I was wondering if you could just share maybe some your fondest memories or what stands out to you about the longtime Devil.
Great player. It's amazing that he's, you know, he played that long for one team. You don't see that a lot nowadays. And he was a winner. They obviously had some great teams there, and he was a big part of those. And I played a handful of games against him, but he was always a guy that, you know, we had to watch. He was a sneaky player, really good scorer, good skater, really heads up player, smart player. So, what a career for him, and nice that they're going to honor him upcoming here.
Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And you know, if it is the end of a career, it's been a long and a great career for you, but hopefully you can keep playing, though.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I've got some options here, but we'll talk it over with the family, and we'll make the right decision for us.
Okay, awesome. Thanks a lot, Josh.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
On the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at Bernstein's Deli, NHLTradeDeadline.com. We've got Ken Danico coming up at 10:30. We're going to bring Ken on to talk about Patrick Elias, who retired yesterday. Speaking of players who are retiring or thinking about retiring, Ken Danico won 2 Stanley Cups with Patrick Elias. Danico's actually got 3 Stanley Cups. I want to talk about Patrick Elias here, guys, this segment, and whether we think that he's a Hall of Famer. He wouldn't be eligible for the Hall of Fame next year. Timo Solani will be eligible for the Hall of Fame next year. Wanted to get your guys' opinion on that. Do you think Patrick Elias is a Hall of Famer? And of the possible players that could be inducted into the 2017 Hall of Fame, who do you have going in? And I'm assuming that we all have Timo Solani going in next year.
Oh, yeah.
So do you want to go Elias first? I mean, you know, the guy has over 1,000 points. He has the Stanley Cups. He has the pedigree. He was a phenomenal playmaker when he played. And, you know, he was the consummate professional. I mean, I think that it's hard. You're hard-pressed to think of the things that he was incapable of doing when you're trying to, you know, strike against his career when you're valuing it as a whether he was a Hall of Famer or not. But, I mean, to me, for my money, I thought Patrick Elias always was – an excellent player and always came out to play. So I could see him as a Hall of Famer. Wouldn't really bat an eyelash if he was nominated.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you want to talk about the utmost of class. Patrick Elias exemplifies that. Spends his entire career with the New Jersey Devils, so a loyal guy, or a guy that the Devils didn't want to get rid of over his entire career. Like Davey mentioned, he's got the Cups. He's got the international pedigree. Represented the Czech Republic a variety of years. I mean, there's really not much else you can say about that. Sneaky scorer, great skater, great playmaker, lest we forget the kick pass. I mean, this guy's got it all. First ballot Hall of Famer, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you guys know what my opinion is. I have Patrick Elias as a Hall of Famer, and it's...
Don't you have a Patrick Elias tattoo?
Yeah, I just don't show it very often. Patrick Elias, we talked about, he played 21 years in the NHL. He's got the point totals. For me, it's the longevity and the Stanley Cup pedigree. And, Sean, you mentioned he won the gold medal with Czech Republic back in 1998. And he has just been a phenomenal player for the Devils. Going back to the rest of the eligible players for the Hockey Hall of Fame class, you've got some interesting options here, guys, some names that we've seen for some time now, but you've also got a player like Daniel Alfredsson who's eligible for the first time. In your opinion, is Daniel Alfredsson a Hall of Famer?
I think so. I don't think there's any question. I think that he's been, again, he's in that Elias class of just was a phenomenal player for his entire career. You know, I mean, did I like the switch over at the end? Probably trying to chase the Stanley Cup. Probably not. That's the one thing about Elias I really do respect, though. I do love the fact that I like when players stay with one organization their entire career. I like that continuity. But I don't think that detracts from Daniel Alfredsson's play in the NHL throughout his career.
Is Theo Fleury getting in this year, Sean?
I'm looking at the list right now, and I'm trying to figure out who has priority over who. And yeah, like it's Theo Fleury's 9th year of eligibility, and I think he goes in before some of the other first or second year eligible players. Look at Dave Andrechuk, also 9th year of eligibility. Is Dave Andrechuk a Hall of Famer?
I don't know. Dave Andrechuk would be a little more bubble for me. What about you, Wes?
I think we have these arguments every year on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I remember going back to when Drew Ritchie and I had these arguments, and it goes back to, is it the Hockey Hall of Fame of great players or the Hockey Hall of Fame of just very good players, right? And I think when you're talking about Dave Andrechuk, I think you could certainly make the argument that he's a Hall of Famer. But for me, Theo Fleury has to go in before Dave Andrechuk, right? And Dave Andrechuk, of course, has 500-plus goals, right? But when you're talking about Mark Recchi, I think Mark Recchi's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
12th all-time in points.
Alex McGillney?
Alex McGillney, to me, is also a Hall of Famer.
I think Mark Recchi stands out to me, though, on that list when you look at players who should be in the Hall of Fame. And Mark Recchi maybe doesn't get the respect he deserves because he played on some very good hockey teams. But he was such a, like, tough player. I mean, he was such a little ball of, like, you know, can-do. And I always liked watching Recchi's game. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't make it because, I mean, it's already his 4th year of eligibility, and I think he's more than deserving.
I mean, you're talking about players like Paul Kariya and Jeremy Roenick, then I think you're getting into that gray area of, are those guys Hall of Famers or are they just on the cusp of being a Hall of Famer, right? Paul Kariya, obviously, his career was cut short, but he still ended up scoring a point per game in just under 1,000 games, right? And, you know, he won gold with Canada at the Olympics. He was a pretty good player for a long time, even though, you know, you maybe expected him to play a little bit longer. And then when you're talking about Jeremy Roenick, again, a guy who scored 500-plus goals, 1,216 career points. He never won the Stanley Cup. But are players like Jeremy Roenick and Daniel Alfredson going to be hurt by that, that they never won the Stanley Cup?
I think so. I think when you look at all the pedigrees of everyone else who's on the bubble here, and then you're looking at however nth degree or nth year of eligibility, you take into consideration, because only so many players can go in every year. And when you got a guy who's a cup winner as opposed to a guy who's put up significant amount of points throughout his career but never really had the postseason success, I think you take that into consideration.
Yeah, and when you're talking about Theo Fleury, he won his cup back when he started his career in 1989, right? So does that really factor in when you consider that the most of his good years were when he wasn't winning the Stanley Cup? Really, it was winning the Canada Cup and the 2002 Olympics when he was a big part of that team with Mario Lemieux and Jerome Iginla and Joe Sakic. That's, I think, when most people would agree that those were his best years. So it's going to be a very interesting class. Going back to what we said before, you know, Tamu, we expect him to go in first ballot Hall of Famer, right? I've said on this show many times that I think he's the best European player of all time. And I think we would all be shocked if Tamu doesn't go in first ballot.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I think Timo Solani is a first ballot Hall of Famer. And it's interesting because, you know, we talk about whether Stanley Cups are impactful, but the truth is, like, as he just talked about, like, you have a player like Theo Fleury who won one in his rookie season. You know, how significant a role did he play on the Flames team that year that, you know, they won versus, you know, a player who gets it later in his career when he's maybe a more veteran player and playing a bigger role. So I think you have to look at the nuance there, number one. But number two, the Stanley Cup's a collective, you know, team victory. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, individuals generally don't win Stanley Cups. So, I mean, unless it's a goaltender perhaps. But generally, you know, you're not doing it alone. So a player to me that's of real interest is Paul Kariya, because I think Paul Kariya was one of the best players of that generation. And if not for those injuries, I mean, he 989 points in 989 games, I believe. I mean, Paul Kariya was a talent, and he was a wizard with the puck. And again, if he wasn't felled with those injuries, I think he would have had a long career that, if you extrapolated out, was a no-doubter Hall of Fame career. So the question is, should he be penalized because he was injured? You know, like, should that be held? I mean, look at what he accomplished, right? He won the gold medal. He was a Hobey Baker winner. He won, I think, two Lady Bings. So, I mean, the guy has some serious pedigree, and he had some serious talent. And, yes, he never got it done in the final analysis of winning a Stanley Cup. But he has a lot of other kind of awards under his name that I think merit recognition in the Hall of Fame.
Here's another question for you guys. Jaromir Jagr, 45 years old, says he's going to play at least one more year, might play till he's 50. When Jaromir Jagr decides to retire, should he get into the Hall of Fame right after he retires?
You mean waiving
the three-year period that is normally applied to players?
Yeah, I think, you know, he's one of those guys in the category of, like, you know, the Gretzky's and the Lemieux and that, you know, just for the Gordie Howes, the longevity of his career and how, I mean, you know, we forget, despite the fact that he's still able to put up some significant points, we just sometimes forget about how dominant Jaromir Jagr was. And the most amazing thing to me about Jaromir Jagr was the KHL years. Because if you don't remove those KHL years, where are his final numbers? I mean, his final numbers would have been incredible. So, I think there's no doubt. I mean, the problem for him is that he's never retiring. So I think this will be an academic conversation for another 3 or 4 years until he hits that 50 mark.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, you know, when you look at, you know, Teemu Selänne, he had to wait 3 years. There were some questions over whether or not, you know, he would get in right after he retired. And obviously, if it's for Jaromir Jagr, they're going to make an exception. But you make an interesting point, Dave, about Jaromir Jagr's time in the KHL, right? He's got 760-whatever goals. If he doesn't spend those 3 years in Russia, he's easily at 800. And then maybe he's getting a little bit closer to Gretzky's record. You never know. I mean, once you get around, you know, 800, 810, 820, it gets a little bit interesting. He definitely would not pass Gretzky, but he would certainly pass you know, Gordie Howe for second all time. So it's very interesting. And then you can also throw in Jerome Iginla as someone who should go into the Hall of Fame. If not right after he retires, he will go in when he first has eligibility. Mm-hmm. So two guys right there. We know that they're both going to go into the Hall of Fame. And I think it's Patrick Eliash is going to be a very interesting case because he has the Stanley Cup pedigree. He has the numbers. But I think when you think of the all-time greats, he might be a little bit below those all-time greats. Not for me. I might be biased because I'm a Devils fan. But what he did for the Devils, and I also think there's something to be said for playing your entire career with one team. I don't think that that really factors in whether you're going to be a Hall of Famer or not. But I think it's just cool because we don't see that very often anymore. We just don't. I mean, Shane Doan, I think, is the exception along with Patrick Eliash as far as playing your entire career with one team. Let's head to break now. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Ken Danico, New Jersey Devils analyst on MSG+, three-time Stanley Cup champion, played long time with Patrick Eliash. So we're going to talk to Ken about Patrick. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.